Hey
Hello.
there. Oh, hey.
Hey,
Hey.
up.
Hey.
Up.
Hi.
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 You're a little cutty outy.
Am I?
Well, you're there now.
Are you sure it wasn't because we were just interrupting one another with little noises we were making?
I don't know. I thought the button in the thing said we're not supposed to do that.
Oh.
It's not
Yeah.
supposed to make the audio so we can't hear each other ever.
Well. Who knows how podcasts work? How you doing?
All right. I moved my stuff back over, so my microphone's back on the other side of the desk, and now I'm reacclimating.
Oh man, big changes.
You know, they say it only takes 2 weeks to start a new habit, and I had the microphone on the other side for 2 weeks, so now I feel like that's the normal side, and this is weird, and I'm all like not sitting in the right place. I'm sliding my chair, I'm moving my thing here.
Let's just put a microphone on either side, and that way you can have all your bases covered, and you can also have a makeshift recording studio for your collectible card game empire.
My what?
I don't know. You should start a collectible card game. I've been
Oh.
trying to get you to start making cards,
Yeah.
not for or against humanity, but just specifically like collectible cards that are dumb. That have things on them, but it but
It's literally basically birds on furniture, except they're not like paper cards, they're digital stickers.
digital stickers, the most satisfying form of stickers.
Yeah. You
Yeah.
remember we did a Christmas edition last year? There was a 1 month only Christmas edition that had a wreath and some other things in it.
You guys missed the boat for Halloween theme stuff though.
Well, I mean, it's not really our full-time job, so hitting schedules these days is rather difficult.
Yes, and for those curious what birds on furniture is, one time there was a cohort, a Mr. Alexander Matt, Alexander comma Matt, sorry, and he said something about birds and furniture, like one on top of the other, and then there were questions about which birds and which pieces of furniture, and somehow that was mutated by you and Rye into a series of digital stickers of different birds and different pieces of furniture, which I feel like was only the natural progression from
Sure, of course.
that.
I mean, you're missing the point that also Nicolas Cage was in there in the beginning as well, in terms of comparison. I believe we were describing what he may look like if somebody were to mistake a bald eagle on top of a coat rack or something. But yeah, it's a system of measurement wherein you compare the relative sizes of things by putting birds on top of various furniture items. But yes, it was basically a fugue state by a very tired Mr. Matt Alexander, and we turned it into an iMessage sticker pack, which is free on the App Store, number 25 in celebrities
25 and celebrities.
currently. I don't know what that means, because we're not even in a category called celebrities. I think we're in a category called animals or something.
I just wonder if some poor intern is like, I don't know where to put this thing on the
Some guy at the App Store is like, this thing is just wild and I can't believe it exists, so I'm just gonna like hashtag celebrities this.
Yeah.
Because who
Maybe
else would put their faces in an iMessage sticker pack if they weren't celebrities?
unclear. I was gonna say that is for me the highlight of the sticker pack, rather,
Yeah.
you know, instead of the birds and the furniture that it is known for. I really just enjoy putting your face or Rye's face or Matt's face onto various things. So that's always, I get a kick out of that. It's fun.
Yeah, I mean, really, it is a veiled way to have some folks that you know's faces in an iMessage sticker pack. But you know, if in terms of our internal classification system, everything in the app is either a bird or a piece of furniture. So it's really incumbent upon the user to decide whether or not they think our faces are birds or furniture.
Is that the category of faces, or each face in particular should be decided whether or not it is bird or a furniture piece?
You know, I'm not gonna make any broad statements. I think a person could either be a bird or a furniture, and it can vary between people. Some people are better at being placed atop things, and some people are better at having things placed atop them.
Sounds very objectivist and Randian.
Yeah,
But
it's
anyway,
we're passing the savings along to the user.
App Store shrugged. So it's available people. And you can also do the fun thing of, like, if you have, like, a video, you can use it as, like, an AR sticker.
I'll be honest. That was a happy accident that I didn't realize we were capable of doing until Ultra Nerd posted a photo of himself with a bird on it. I'm like, well, how did he do that? It doesn't look like he took a screenshot of an iMessage and then cropped it. I'm like, oh, yeah, the iMessage camera. And then I did that, and then I placed a bird on my forehead, and then I realized it was trashed to me. And I'm like, you know what? This is genius.
Well, I actually sent you when I got the iPhone XS. I actually recorded the video with the sticker of
it's true. You did
your face on my face, and Rye's face on my face, and Matt's face on my face. Just, you know, for that disturbing level. Because
it's pretty great. We should make a version where there are eye holes in our faces so you can fully embody us.
It would just be a little too weird. It's hard to get the alignment right because it seems to want to put it on a plane, and if you turn your head too much, it seems to want to stick the thing to a different plane of your face.
It definitely doesn't understand rotation. Yeah.
No. I mean, but the future of, you know, stuff is AR, VR, whatever. Good luck with that, Tim.
The future of TV is sticking people's faces on your face.
Yeah, but this is neither here nor there. As much as we imbue these stickers with life, it is. It is for us to imbue corpses with life and to...
Yeah, pretending to be somebody that you're not, mm-hmm. sort of, in a weird way.
Yeah. I mean, it's a comedy. So for Foxtober, we were doing predominant, notable franchises that Disney is absorbing. And one of the things
Did
Disney...
Did we say notable? Did we really say notable?
I don't think we said notable. But we were doing franchises that Disney is absorbing. And it's spooky. Brands eating brands. This was maybe a mistake. Because while there have been two Weekend at Bernie's movies, they are not wildly successful. Although they are, I think, widely known. For the cult shtick of things referencing Weekend at Bernie's and Weekend at Bernie's 2, it is in itself not a notable creation that I envision Disney revisiting at any point.
Yeah, I mean, this says it made $30 million with a budget of $15 million, so it's almost potentially theoretically profitable. But yeah, it's. You can summarize this movie in a sentence or two, mm-hmm. and then you don't really need to see it. But it's good to see it. I think just because it's very 1989, and you got your Andrew McCarthy in there, you got your Jonathan Silverman, both being very much them, and Bernie. Bernie's great. He does the performance of a lifetime. pun intended, I suppose.
Terry Kisser,
I read it as Kaiser. I have no idea, though.
All right. Well, Terry Kaiser. Terry. We'll just call him Terry. He is Bernie. He's the point of it. He is the whole reason why we're here is Bernie. And he is very good at not being alive, which sounds like a weird compliment to pay somebody, but he has to be limp and drag, you know, ragdoll around a set, and he has to have his eyes open when it would, I think, be rather difficult to keep your eyes open without flinching or blinking or anything. Like, I don't know how many takes they had to do.
Somersaults. He's got to get, like, hit with stuff. Like, it's astounding. Like, it's like when you talk about good visual effects where you can't tell the difference between, like, something practical and something modified. There are times here where it's like, okay, that has to be a dummy. And then you're, like, looking real close. I'm like, is that a real person there? Is he really doing that? No, you would want a person to do that, but then you couldn't do that because that would hurt a lot. But is that it? Doesn't look like a dummy.
Yeah. No, he's very skilled at this. I'm really not kidding when I say that he does a good job at being dead for the most of the runtime of this film. The joke that comes out of, you know, he's dead is not completely effective, but his performance, I think, works. Even when he's alive, he's a pretty good, smarmy, awful, nasty gross man. So he embodies this awful character of Bernie very well.
I feel like if he wasn't, he should have been nominated for some sort of stunt award for this movie, because he definitely did some stunts.
Yeah. It's hard to tell in some shots because, of course, they put sunglasses on him and a hat in some cases and flop him around.
Yes, they do. Go ahead.
Yeah. There are some where you could definitely tell that it is him.
Although the part where his toupee comes off and they like staple gun the toupee back to his head, like there are parts where it's just like, I think that's a dummy. And then there's a part where it's like him in a bald cap and then with a toupee. And it's like, well, okay, from a distance, that's, I think, pretty sure that's just him.
Yeah, the bald cap was more obvious as a giveaway.
But he's so good at being like that rag doll, just completely limp. And they're just like picking him up and propping him up against the wall to put the hair back on him.
Yeah, I have to imagine that must have been very difficult for him. Of course, if you watch the trailer for Weekend at Bernie's 2, you realize that he gets to really expand the role when he returns to it. Because at the end of this
he started a literal dance craze that showed up, 25, 30 years later?
So we didn't, of course, do that movie. We didn't do that movie because, I mean, while I think that Weekend at Bernie's, the first one, is the lesser admired because it's less bananas than the second one, just because the second one is, there's just straight up quote-unquote voodoo from the Hollywood writing minds that were deployed on it. So there's magic that occurs in a sense where he is halfway resurrected, but it was a defective resurrection, and he can only move towards the treasure that he's supposed to be moving towards if the
certain music playing.
Yeah, and that it results in stuff, but he basically gets to like do a little shuffle dance thing around for the entire movie whenever music is playing. Whereas in this one, he's actually alive and then killed and then is just limp, a ragdoll limp thing for the rest of the film.
Mostly limp.
Yeah. There was a scene with some rigor mortis, but so this... This movie starts with ADR, which is, I think, probably it should have. I think whoever did the looping on this movie probably spent more time on it than some of the actors did on set some days, because it is just crazy. You're just watching this and you're just like, so that's replaced dialogue. 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 That is okay. That one they actually recorded on set because you can hear room sound, and then that's all replaced dialogue, etc. And you just go through the whole movie like that. And it's very obvious whenever it happens. These are not smooth, gradual little insertions. Like there'll be an entire scene where there is no dialogue from an on-set recording, and presumably because either the microphone was set up incorrectly or they decided they didn't like the audio that they had recorded on set.
It seems to me that they had very limited time, both on location and in post, so they did an initial pass at basically everything, and they had to kind of live with that.
Yeah. Like, there are some of these things where they loop the dialogue and the characters' mouths aren't moving, which, you know, it's one thing if you're replacing audio because there was, like, some sort of an audio problem on set, there was a loud noise or something, and you couldn't hear the person, they weren't mic'd properly, the boom was not plugged in that day, I don't know, there are reasons
there's
why
audio hits, there's performance differences. Usually if you're going to throw in some ADR when somebody literally didn't say anything, or you need to make two lines happen closer together when they didn't actually happen that close together on set, you'll see the back of somebody's head and you can tell that they didn't really say it because they're jaw isn't moving, but it's not generally like you can see the front of their face, even if it's across the room. I only noticed once in this movie where there was ADR when somebody wasn't actually talking, and the person was kind of sort of hidden across the room, but yeah, you could still tell they weren't actually talking.
Yeah, also when the mobster girlfriend goes down the staircase and she's making her little...
Oh, her song?
Yeah, scat, whatever jazz thing that she's doing, and then she sits down and makes little, like, vocal sound effects for her sitting and stuff. Mm-hmm. None of that is happening with her mouth on set. But then they cut immediately to her talking and with regular dialogue in the following shot. So it's just really strange. But I have a feeling that it's the sort of thing that you just, you know, it was just what it was back then, especially if you were putting together such a low budget production. There's, you know, you have a limited days on set, like you said, you got to get in there, get stuff recorded, and then you're assembling this thing, you're like, oh, this joke doesn't land, or we got to cut that, and then you smooth it all over or whatever, or you realize that maybe the girlfriend walks down the staircase for a really long time over to the chair, nothing is happening on screen or auditorially, so you might as well just...
Suddenly, it's just silent for like 3 minutes. Yeah, honest. I mean, it's a low-budget movie in the 80s, and I wouldn't expect really much different, but it is one of those things that sticks out to you.
Yeah, and like you said, this movie looks very 1989.
And part of that I absolutely love, because... aside from the fact that it's just general nostalgia, like the world of this movie is hilariously fake. It's just like all of the like the absurdly rich people just meandering about this island, having parties and stuff, and just like the way they're all dressed and the way they act, and like the idea of their lifestyles is just hilariously absurd. And I love watching that through a 1988 lens or whenever they filmed this.
Yeah, but also the... In addition to the costuming, there you have the set design, which is unique. This is definitely, I think this is an era that most people don't remember, because you had stuff that looked like it was the 80s, which was like, I don't know, 84 to 87, I would say. Looked very 80s. And then you got this stuff that's 88, 89, and 90, 91, and it kind of looks like its own different thing.
It's like the 80s got really polished basically when they were over.
Yeah.
Like you talk about like your Die Hard 2s and your Tony Scott's and things, like those sorts of things got some style to them, and they feel like, yeah, this was the cool 80s, but it was basically 1990.
The cool 80s.
The cool 80s, you know, if such thing exists.
The cool ladies man busts to the wall, you know. But anyway.
Oh man, sorry, not to derail this conversation, but I was just poking around looking at stuff, and I think Bernie's house is gone and it's now a hotel, and I'm heartbroken.
I'm not. It was a hideous monstrosity.
Oh, it was amazing. For, again, 1980s. It's got this ridiculous like artsy like just pillar that goes up and then over the house, and it's just like it's designed for literally no purpose, and it's the inside is hideous, don't get me wrong, but for the outside, from just like an architectural perspective, was hilariously awesome.
I don't know, it was a little extreme. In the interior, yes, it's just hideous. There's an opening shot where they establish our would-be protagonists as being in awe of the place, and you're just staring at a white tile floor that goes as far as the eye can see with the most,
and they're all like the 1 foot by 1 foot tiles too, so clearly he wasn't spending a whole lot of money on his beach house. Maybe because he knew a lot of people were gonna come in with sand in their shoes and just grind it into the floor and just ruin everything.
Yeah, well, and it's also one thing to have like a plain white tile, it's another thing to have a white tile that has like a faux marble texture thing in it very faintly, and then have that everywhere. I don't know, it's just, it looked like a retirement home. It was a very odd choice, but you're supposed to be basking in the opulence of this, and you're looking at the nouveau art deco couches and stuff that are like in burgundy and chartreuse.
Oh, I love the house, the couches, the way they're like turned on their side, like little diamonds with like a connector in between. Like, it's got to be the most uncomfortable couch you've ever sat on.
Yeah. I think those are technically chaise. They might be couches.
They're basically like those little mini couches you put at the end of your bed, if there's a name for that, for when you just sit on to put your shoes on when you get old.
Bench.
Sure, bench. Yeah, something
but,
like that.
Yeah, this is more substantial than a bench. But
this website here informs me, and I'm trying to vet it. It says that this house was built specifically for the movie and torn down afterwards.
Oh, there go your heartfelt memories.
I would spend some money to have a weekend at Bernie's if such a place still existed. Like, if this was an Airbnb destination, I would totally go. I would get some friends together. I assume there's you know, like, five bedrooms there. You know, we could all split it.
Good luck with that.
Put up a big movie screen on the beach outside and watch Weekend at Bernie's.
You are the Larry Wilson of this, because I am, I guess, the Richard Parker who wants nothing to do with that idea of yours. But
wait, you said I'm the Andrew McCarthy?
Yes. Yeah.
Call me lazy?
No, Larry Wilson is the character's name.
Yeah, he was lazy.
Oh, I thought you misheard me saying Larry. Oh, Larry,
no.
Lazy. Oh, I see how it works.
No, he just wanted to go to the beach, and he got roof tar all over their paperwork.
Yes, yes. So New York is hot and gross in the summer, and they take that to an extreme.
You think they hit that hard enough in this movie? Hot enough for you? Sticking to the ground? Like, I mean, the sticking was a little funny the first one or two times, but then it got a little old. But then I did like the way he just, you know, didn't even care. He just got roof tar all over his papers.
What I liked was when they went to his office later and he hadn't printed them up again. He still had the roof tar papers.
Oh, yeah, that's printer ink right there.
Yeah. So they are there working on the weekend. The only two people doing it. And Andrew McCarthy is playing this character of Larry Wilson, who is kind of doesn't want to do any work but wants to be promoted a lot and stuff. I know a lot of people think, oh, that's like a millennial, but it's not. It's really like, this is how just people are written sometimes. He's there, and then you got your Richard Parker, who is all buttoned up and wants to put his nose to the grindstone and really like get it done and do everything by the book.
Yeah, it's great when they go to Bernie's house there. He's like, oh, see, this is what working hard and just, you know, putting your head down at work can get you someday. You can have a giant house like this surrounded by all these party people. And no, it's just if you embezzle millions of dollars.
Yes.
The moral of the story. So basically, work hard and you'll get nothing. Steal and you can be rich and have lots of fun. And then maybe eventually get killed with, I don't know, did he give him a drug overdose or did he inject him with poison or something? I don't know. It was one of those two.
It was not described specifically what was inside the syringe, but it was very fast acting, so I don't think it was simply a drug overdose.
I mean, given the way he like put the syringe next to the bag of, I assume, heroin and stuck it in his pocket or whatever, I thought that's what the vibe they were trying to insinuate.
Yeah, but I don't think it instantly kills you when you get shot in the butt with it.
I don't know. It depends on how much heroin's in it.
I guess. Maybe it was doctored up with something else, but we establish it's hot and they want to get ahead, and Richard Parker and Larry Wilson, they have this odd couple thing going on, and he finds the money that they're there presumably looking into, and it's $2 million, and it's because somebody was writing insurance policies and cashing them out after somebody had already died, and so somebody's embezzling this money, and so they're gonna tell Bernie Lomax, their boss, about it when it's Monday morning. And sure enough, they go in and they try to do it, and then they try to do it, and they keep seeing like hints of him because he's not ready to talk to them. He's too busy with getting in late and maybe taking drugs, kind of, and also talking to the ladies and taking one of them to lunch with a car. But somehow it's near the office where they were having hot dogs. So he went down, got a car, picked up somebody, came back to have lunch at the office, and then I guess would leave from there. But long story short.
He's not going to walk. He's going to have the air conditioning in his Porsche there.
Yeah. It's a very subtle car.
I like that he had the golf cart made up to look just like his red Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
Hilarious.
That was a good touch. But he, you know, he finally has the meeting with them. He's not really treating them with any kind of respect and doesn't really care. And he just kind of wants to do whatever with this meeting. And he's, you know, distracted by going to the bathroom and stuff until they finally spell out what it is that they're there for. And then suddenly he's very interested and he tells them to call him Bernie. You know, his father is Mr. Lomax, which is just about the cheesiest line you could write. But he tries to get them to come to his house over Labor Day weekend. He thinks it's gonna be great and how they shouldn't tell anybody else because they should keep this under wraps just in case. Of course, then Bernie goes and he talks to mobsters and they are, I don't know, My Blue Heaven style mobsters.
They've gone legit, but they're also bad people, and they eat Italian food loudly. Whoa, he was eating a salad though, so it was kind of hilarious. He was complaining about the lack of walnut dressing, and then
it was a raspberry vinaigrette.
Yeah, to show how disgusting and horrible and tasteless of a human he is, rather than eating his food or spitting it out, he literally pulls it out of his mouth with his fingers, which is just the worst. But the thing that I like about at least the first act of this movie, maybe the first one and a half acts of this movie, is that it's generally like it's about as serious as any sort of 80s style movie. Like the themes, it's not a comedy like right out of the gate. Like you've got your quirky 80s characters, but they're just like dudes working in a company trying to get ahead and, you know, trying to find major fraud. Like this could have very easily like pivoted into like a serious workplace drama with just these like slightly quirky characters, but it turns into something so absurd. But it starts off so like, I mean, kind of serious. I mean, not particularly earnest, but like it's serious about what they're dealing with. Like you've got your mobsters, you've got your fraud.
Yeah, earnest is a different kind of comedy. Earnest goes to Bernie's.
I don't know what I just said, but apparently.
Oh yeah, I accidentally triggered it as well. I don't know.
What in the hell?
Siri is super special today. But
oh boy.
There's the weekend of Bernie's vibe that happens later when they're actually on the island. But in this part of it, it is, like you're saying, a much more standard.
Am I wrong that that's weird though? That it like sticks out, that it's kind of like, it's like your 80s working man movie. It may as well be Secret of My Success or whatever. And then it turns into carrying around a corpse.
Well, I think the thing that gives it away as not being a working man story is because it has these really badly written pieces of dialogue and really dumb jokes about Jaime's Hunan and stuff like that, where you have bad comedy writing that tips you off that it's supposed to be a comedy.
But there's like, you know, his whole like aw shucks thing that he's, the game that he's throwing at this girl, and you're like, oh, he's gonna try and end up with the girl later or whatever, and it's like, they're steering into the fact that you know that it's going to be this sort of like awkward 80s romance thing, and you know he's gonna screw it up, and he's gonna have a real connection, but then he's gonna do something dumb, and he's gonna drive her away, and he's gonna have to win her back later. But that's the setup, and then all of that takes a back seat to the fact that there's a dead body that they're carting around. So like, and of course you've got to deal with the you know, the miscommunication. So it's basically like, he's dead. They're going to think we did it. How do we make them not think we did it? Well, we're kind of distracted because of this party just wandered in. Maybe we should like report it later so we can have a fun weekend, which is a horrible thing to do. And they're kind of conflicted about it. And then it's like, well, somebody killed him or something. And then they don't know that he set them up. And like, they're learning things all along the way that like, A, he's dead. B, he was murdered. See, like, he was trying to have them murdered, and they got to carry him around so that they don't get murdered because they think that the hitman won't kill him while he's around. And then the hitman's there, and he's just, like, straight up shooting everybody. And then it just turns into, like, Abbott and Costello meet the mummy or whatever. And they're just, like, running around in circles and yelling and waving their arms like their hair's on fire. And it's just like, what? How did this movie about, like, insurance fraud suddenly turn into this absurd thing?
Well, I think it was always intended to be absurd. I don't think it was like an evolutionary thing where it just it accidentally happened towards the end.
No, I feel like it comes on so slow that they're just like they're leading you on, obviously, and it's very clear and obvious where they're going, and you're like, okay, of course they're, because we know everything up front. We know that he set up the guys to get killed. We know that he himself got killed because of all of this dealings, and we know that everyone else is going to find that out eventually. And we know what's his name's gonna get the girl in the end, because of course, why wouldn't he? But you're just like, what are they gonna do? They're not gonna do more weird stuff with his dead body, like the girlfriend. Like, they're not gonna do more of that. And you just keep watching, and you're like, oh my god, why are they doing this? And all of it sort of comes to the head at the end there, when they're basically just like, oh yeah, he's dead. And then when he flops out on the sand, and they basically just run away, and then it's just like credits, that you're just like, what? But dead guy and money and embezzling and murder and stuff.
Yeah,
it's truly a peculiar and just slapstick ride of a movie based on just like a really weird pseudo serious premise, and I find that unusual and notable is probably the wrong word, but memorable.
I don't think it's as notable as you think it is. I think there are a lot of slapstick movies that have a serious start that, you know, it's just there to set up the stuff that the joke is supposed to bounce off of. This is, I don't think, any different than some other comedies, yeah. but it is a slow start to get to the part where there is the dead Bernie comedy part. Unfortunately, yeah. That is also perhaps not that funny.
Right, that's a lot of what the review said. Like, there's one joke that's not that funny, and they keep playing it over and over again. Although I think that they sort of play the joke in a couple of different ways, so I think that makes it a little easier to swallow more than once. But yeah, it's a whole movie about carting around a dead guy.
Yeah, and so it would have been better if they beefed up the stuff around Bernie being dead, I think, because they tried to have other comedic parts to it, like the whole thing with Richard Parker played by Jonathan Silverman, trying to have his trying to have a relationship with the intern Gwen Saunders before it's her last day at, you know, the end of the summer and stuff. She is, of course, the oldest intern ever because she's 30. But it's also kind of weird because then you start wondering, well, how old is Jonathan Silverman supposed to be playing in this, that he is, making out with the intern? But
he's out of college. He's living with his parents. He's a little too old to still be living with them, but he's trying to save some money.
Yeah, so hopefully they're not crazy out of alignment for their ages. But in terms of casting, they seem fine. It's just one of those things where it was obviously written as an intern, and they say that several times, and how she's going back to school, and so it's like, it's a little strange. but there's supposed to be comedy there between them, like his bad lying to make it seem like he has his life together and has a certain amount of status. Like, he's just like the worst liar. And they try to play that for laughs, and this is before Bernie dies, and then they keep trying to play it for laughs after Bernie dies. And then they try to go in a serious direction with it. And it's hard to do because he's so inept that Gwen would have to be a complete and totally stupid hollow vessel to not understand exactly what's going on here. Like, she doesn't seem to she gets offended, but it's just like to leave so that they can keep doing Bernie stuff and then come back later. They never really like sort out anything with her.
I mean, luckily she was able to see the real him on that date until he turned into a lunatic about his parents.
Yes, because Jonathan Silverman lied and said that his parents had died and left him the place, rather than just saying he lived with his parents. And his dad walked out in nothing but underwear and went to get something from the fridge, and he tried to say that it was his butler. And
that's it. I found that funny. I particularly found the dad was as a dad actually would be. He's like, would you please lay out my blazer? He said, how about I lay you out? And just walked away with his big belly out. It was just like, yep, that's great. Love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that is supposed to be a source of hilarity for that that character. He's supposed to be a funny guy, but it's all in that sort of situational, like, I don't know, Ben Stiller-esque, like, awkward, painful comedy. And I
mean, Jonathan Silverman is basically the 80s How I Met Your Mother, what's his name guy.
Oh, yeah.
Looks like him, acts like him. They're both very similar in terms of their relationship antics and things.
I don't like him on the show either.
I think, you know, Jonathan Silverman was better at it.
Yeah.
I don't know that he really kept it going.
Well, he had that one show from the creators of, like, Caroline in the City or whatever, the single something on NBC. I don't remember the name of it.
Jonathan Silverman did
it? Yeah, Jonathan Silverman. He had a couple seasons of that, I think, on the television shows.
Hmm.
But I don't think he's done a whole lot of other stuff since then. Oh, yeah, The Single Guy, which aired on NBC starting in 1995.
I wonder what that's about. I bet there's relationships and antics and things.
Mm-hmm. It ran for two seasons.
Oh my, look at Ernest Borgnine. Are you and you got that one guy. What's this guy's name here? Which one is he?
Oh, Ming-Na was in it? That's interesting. And Olivia Diabo.
That's the guy. Oh my god. We should watch an episode of this. The cover art for this on IMDb looks like made it in MS Paint as a meme.
I think it was canceled for a reason, Dan. When I saw this, I remembered advertisements for it, but there's just nothing about his career that really makes me think of him very much.
The creator of it was the producer of Must Love Dogs. Remember Must Love Dogs?
No.
It was a movie about relationships and dogs.
Mm.
Diane Lane, John Cusack.
He was in Caddyshack too.
Oh, that's right. Oh my god, he was like basically the main character.
Yeah, I told you he's kind of forgettable.
See, in Caddyshack 2 is too matchy-matchy with his personality. Like, you need him in contrast of something. So Andrew McCarthy is a little bit of contrast to him, as well as the rest of this movie. But Jonathan Silverman is basically the human embodiment of Caddyshack 2. So you can't put those two things together. It's just too much.
It's not really a high compliment. Please never listen to this Jonathan Silverman.
I think he probably, even still, has better things to do than listen to this particular podcast.
I don't think he's seeking out our feedback. But
no.
Yeah, no, there was and of course Andrew McCarthy, like I see him but recognize him from zero things, but he's in a lot of things, especially notable things in the 80s, St. Elmo's Fire and Pretty in Pink and Less Than Zero and stuff.
He's an 80s that guy. You can tell that he's going to be funny and he's going to be kind of insulting and complain a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Terry, I don't recognize for much of anything else, and most of the rest of this cast I don't recognize either. So I think it's one of those situations.
Well, you got Gwen. You know Gwen?
I do, because she was in Last Starfighter.
Right.
She was the love interest. I think she had more to do and a better role in The Last Starfighter than she has here. Sad as that is.
I don't know. I mean, she's between those two movies, her resume just kind of looks like shock and confusion. So, not to typecast or anything, but you know, I was looking at her page earlier and I saw Night of the Comet. Have you looked at this Night of the Comet?
I have not.
Apparently, a comet hits Earth and basically everyone's dead, but they're also zombies. So there's like she's a teenager and there are a couple other teenagers running around killing zombies. And there's nobody else on Earth. And the trailer is one of the worst things I've ever seen. But I kind of want to see it because it's real bad.
Well, it's almost Halloween. Save it for that special day when you're giving candy to all the trick-or-treaters. But
I'll project it on my garage door as they come up.
Yes. You see that, kids? That's Catherine Mary Stewart. She's killing a zombie.
With an Uzi. No, I just would be scarier to play Weekend at Bernie's and be like, this is what the 80s looked like.
Yeah.
Look at that blue windbreaker with that striped shirt underneath.
What's weird is there are a couple of clothing items that would otherwise be in fashion if they weren't so baggy and or tucked in.
Right, like Jonathan Silverman, he's rocking like the button-up shirt all the way to the top with no tie, and he's got the blazer over it. Like, that's a thing people do now.
Well, I think the blazer, not so much this day, but a lot of people do that. But his blazer, of course, had the enormous 80s shoulder pads, and... You know, Agent McCarthy has like his Hawaiian shirt on, but it's all blousy and tucked into the top of his pleated front khakis.
The plaid shorts also in this movie, they need to go.
Yeah.
Oh, his socks too. Like he has like stretched out, loose, billowy socks coming out of his high top Chuck Taylors, which is just, thank goodness that's not coming back.
No, but I have seen a lot of people starting to wear full length or quarter length black socks with black shoes around while they're wearing shorts. I don't know why that's happening. I want to send like a memo that people should stop immediately. Should not happen.
Oh, there was actually in the opening of this movie, remember when they're doing the heat wave, there's a wide shot of the lobby of the building and there's two guys coming in wearing suits with shorts and they both have like calf high dress socks with their dress shoes on.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. That was a good shot.
It's like, well, there's a thing that is like, I mean, it's still ridiculous, but like high fashion now.
Well, I just think it's kind of funny that they set up the shot with the two of them dressed like that walking together and it's like... You gotta space it out, guys. You can't have them both at the same time. They look like twins.
Well, plus, Andrew McCarthy, when he's actually dressed up for work, looks like he made his clothes out of somebody's couch. Like, it's just the worst combination of plaids.
Yes. Yes, plaids. Plural. Pattern on pattern. Well, I think that is, of course, intentional. I don't think he was... I don't think that was considered a stylish look for him back in the day.
No, certainly not. He's... I mean, they're not particularly well-off human beings, but they got to wear suits to work, which is, you know...
And he's a little bit of a devil-may-care, ne'er-do-well kind of a guy, so...
Everybody's
schlubby.
Smoking indoors all over the place. He even tries to light up in Bernie's office, and Bernie says no smoking while he's smoking one of his fancy thin black cigarettes, probably from Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you get the weird thing with the black Maserati.
He spends a little bit too much time complaining about the color of his Maserati, if we're honest.
Yeah, because he wants a Maserati, but only if it's black, and then he says he wants it painted, and then this turns into this whole thing with a neighbor that he has on the island who keeps trying to hunt down Bernie to get the deal closed, and that he's painted the Maserati already, apparently. And that's in some of the loop dialogue when they're doing a golf cart chase. That neighbor I hate. I didn't feel like that really brought much of anything to the table. And he unfortunately has to be the guy who sits down next to Bernie and has to pretend like Bernie is driving a hard deal and not dead. So not the best other character actor to have in here. But of course, all the touches with the consumerism of the 80s, the cars and the house and the electronics with your Modest Mussorgsky Night on Bald Mountain queued up in your cassette player over your hi-fi system.
What do you suppose that was there for?
Unclear. Maybe that's just something he likes to, you know, have on when he's having one of those floating parties come through. Maybe that's how you get people to leave.
I feel like it's one of those things that you would want to just, like, I don't know, get drunk in your house playing that music and, like, shoot bow and arrows at vases or something.
Or just, you know, watch Fantasia and chill out.
When did Fantasia come out?
1930-something? 39? 41-something? I don't know.
Oh, I don't. Who knows?
But Fantasia, of course, has the Night on Bald Mountain. Night on Bald Mountain with the titular mountain.
Is that the one? That's the one with big. The demon monster guy.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
That's
I got Fantasia on VHS around here somewhere.
Yeah. I think I might my mom's storage unit might have it, but on VHS. But I always thought that was a cool one when I was a kid. So of course I'm intimately familiar with the works of Modest Mussorgsky, but I probably have said his name wrong this whole entire time because I literally know no one who has said it aloud ever.
What's his name?
Modest Mussorgsky.
Is that where Modest Mouse got their name?
Maybe.
Hmm.
Maybe they were just
like, this would be a useful factoid for us to give to people.
Modest Mouse's the all bald on okay. No. Modest Mouse's the all, I don't know, I can't come up with anything.
The band's name is derived from a passage from the Virginia Woolf story, The Mark on the Wall.
Oh. Of course. How silly of me to forget that.
Yeah. According to Wikipedia, which is never wrong.
Yeah. No. There's some interesting facts on Wikipedia. Like, this was by a production and company whose logo I didn't recognize, Gladen Entertainment, which had a very interesting logo. And there are some facts that one could look up if they wanted to on the internet, but I don't really want to repeat them. But there was the guy with embezzling, and he may have or may have not killed himself.
It's kind of like the plot of this movie, but in real life.
It's kind of disturbing when you think about that.
Except in real life, it's not funny.
No.
When people don't like dance when voodoo music plays or whatever.
No. Curiously, this was a project that he elected to pursue while embezzling money. And after being convicted of embezzling money several decades prior. I don't know.
It's a perfect crime. Nobody's going to think that you're doing the thing that you're literally making a movie about.
Yes. One thing this movie teaches us is that embezzling is a victimless crime.
Oh, sure. $2 million. Yeah, no big deal.
Yeah. So they, I don't know. They seem, Larry, played by Andrew McCarthy, basically seems to just want to party at the beach house and take stuff for free. And
of course, because being the selfish person that he is, he says, when they find out that Bernie's dead, he says, why do these things always happen to me?
Yeah. It's like, couldn't he have died on a Monday? This is immediately after they find his dead body that he starts having these comments, which makes you...
Well, he's drinking the very expensive champagne out of the bottle.
Yes, Perrier Jouet. But you don't see that a lot these days. It's not as big as it once was.
I mean, a little bit here and there, just because the bottle still signifies this costs a lot of money, and it's easier than the ridiculous Saran wrap on Cristal or something.
Yeah, but you usually see Perrier Jouet with the one of those like collectible sets where they always have like the those Art Nouveau roses like painted on some champagne flutes that they have inside the box.
I get that it's nice or whatever, but I always find the painted on flowers to be very tacky.
But
by the way, I'm very surprised that only $2 million adjusted for inflation is only a little over $4 million. Like, that's honestly, you know, compared to those Wall Street people, he's not really embezzling that much money. Or maybe this is just a single transaction, so he's embezzled a lot more over the years.
It is possible. It's $2 million is a lot-ish to get busted over.
As Andrew McCarthy says, that house probably only costs like 1.6, 1.7. Like, that's you're blowing your whole wad right there. How are you going to live this ridiculous lifestyle with your boats and your cars and things if you only got $300,000 left over?
Yeah, also... They never really explain his relationship with the mob, other than he meets with them and asks that for them to arrange a murder.
I assume that he's doing fake thingy-mabobs insurance fraud schemes with them as well, because the mob guy kind of winks, nudges, and says like, we're legit now, we're investors and stuff. And I assume he means he's investing in things illegally to make returns that are not actually legit.
The movie just doesn't spell it out exactly. Not that I'm demanding that this movie spell out more, but the connection between the two of them is implied, and that he is getting money from them in some way, because the mob boss guy says that Bernie's getting too greedy. not just in reference to his girlfriend, but also to the other stuff.
He's careless, presumably. And a $2 million fraud scheme sticks out to these two little kids. So he's if he would have stuck to maybe some smaller amounts, maybe it wouldn't have been red flagged as quickly or as easily.
Yeah, what if you took like fractions of a cent?
And routed them down into a bank account over about 10 years?
Yeah.
You know, that's a clever plot. Could this be done remotely via some sort of computing device, so you don't even have to be physically present?
It's possible. You definitely need a computer programmer for this, though.
Mm. Mm-hmm. How many?
Well, at least one, if you're Richard Pryor.
Hmm.
Did you ever see Superman 3?
No, but I saw Office Space where they mentioned that it came from Superman 3.
Yes. I feel like because you kept mentioning Office Space things, but not the Superman 3 part.
Yeah, no, I don't think I've seen Superman 3. Based on the description of that being in a Superman movie, I'm not sure why I would want to see it. Does he embezzle enough money to turn himself into a supervillain?
No.
I don't get it.
Superman 3 is a very bad movie for numerous reasons. But basically, computers are evil is the lesson from that.
Oh, does Superman fight a computer?
Yes, but not in the way you think. But that is
oh,
not...
Oh, does he put on like a VR mask and go into it and like punch around like some bits and stuff?
No.
Oh.
No.
Okay.
Like
Johnny Mnemonic, like Lawnmower Man, like VR stuff?
No, a lady's covered in silver paint, and she shoots lightning from her hands.
Oh, a computer turns into a person.
Well, a person turns into a computer.
Person turns into a computer.
Yes.
Huh.
Yes. It's really dumb and bad. Anyway,
what
Richard Pryor said it.
What if instead of the building turning into the robot turned into a bug?
What if the robot turned into
a prehistoric bug?
What if the robot turned into a beetle?
Yeah, why not? Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense.
A bumblebee, or Camaro. But so anyway, this movie, I don't know. I think we've exhausted everything there is to say about it because there's not much else to it other than describing like situational shenanigans, like. There's puppeteering of a dead body. There is the.
I've got my cursor hovering over the gift that you posted that we're live, and it just keeps looping with the waving the arm. Like, how sick is Andrew McCarthy that he's playing Monopoly with the dead body to try and keep up the look? And he like puts a daiquiri in his hand, a very brown looking daiquiri, and sticks a cigarette in his mouth, and it's just like, hey, we're having a great time by the pool and waving to all of our new friends from last night, and. Oh, this is great, but
yeah, and he's like, don't worry, Bernie, this one's not as sweet as the last one.
I mean, there's fun and silliness, and the tone always basically stays light, even to the point where you've got this hitman who killed Bernie and then gets yelled at by his boss because the other guys see that Bernie is not, well, they think they see Bernie not being dead because he's doing things about the island, that he has to go back and, you know, kill him. Two more times, and he basically is just like he's losing his mind because he thinks Bernie is indestructible and unkillable, even though he shot him in the chest and gave him an overdose and choked him in the sand. And it's just like it's slapstick antics, and yet it's repeated assault and murder.
Yeah, but I feel like this would have been more successful had it been one of your like there are dark comedies where there's. Funny stuff about dead things or not alive things. Like, look at the works of Tim Burton, or look at something like Robert Zemeckis's Death Becomes Her. Like, you can have those really dark moments and still have them be funny. But this movie never goes dark. It's just like, and a murder happened. Ta-da! Same flat lighting.
Yeah. And I think the tone of it is the darker parts, the reason it stays so light is entirely due to Don Calfa, who plays Paulie Vito's hitman. Just because he's a goofy character, he's a goofy guy, and he's got his like multiple outfit changes where he shows up like somebody who should not at all be dressed like Don Johnson, and then kills Bernie, and then he puts on his priest outfit, which is a delightful little clip on, and his big silly hat, and then he's got his little ascot and his captain's hat that he comes back with later, and he's just getting more and more frazzled with his crazy hair, and when he actually comes in and shoots him, and then he's just laughing out loud maniacally as he's chasing these people around the house like some sort of Scooby-Doo skit. It's perfect for the tone of this movie, but that's the reason it stays so late all the time. That and the fact that, like, basically Terry Kaiser just, like, he's not moving and his face is funny. Like, the mustache and the cigarette jammed in his lips and the goofy sunglasses, like, he's funny even not moving.
Yeah, well, they do a thing where they kind of, like, stick like a smirk or a half smirk on his face at a couple points in the film. And it's not clear exactly how his face maneuvered into that. Maybe,
I mean, dead people are basically made out of clay, right?
Yeah, maybe Andrew McCarthy's just back there smushing his face around. But yeah, there's stuff where he's got like a funny look on his face, and it's entertaining, but it's not
funny looking. How?
Like, amuse you? Yeah,
literally, he's here to amuse us.
Yes, yes. Yes, like a dead clown. But he's. but I feel like they could. I really do feel like for a black comedy, like, which is like supposedly what this is, you really could have gone darker with this and not have it be so like TV movie light. I just don't think that it works very well, because these people are also supposed to be doing like these really. Well, sociopathic things in the case of Andrew McCarthy, where he's just like doing the Monopoly game and the drinking and stuff. It is just like, could you like make him at least seem like he's untethered from reality in some way? Like, this has unmoored him, but instead it's just sort of like, oh, well, I guess I'm just a guy who likes to play with dead bodies.
I mean, the movie is as dark as Bernie's character is a comic book bad guy. Like, I mean, it's only going to get as serious as his character was serious, and he was pretty cartoony from time to time. And I think Andrew McCarthy kind of gets let off the chain a little bit when you realize, and when he realizes too, that Bernie is a bad guy who was going to have him killed. So he's just like, yeah, well, whatever.
Yeah, well, because... It, at first, if you didn't know all this stuff about Bernie, you would think that these two schmucks are just insanely evil. But because we know, as the audience, that Bernie was a bad guy, we don't feel so bad for Bernie and that they're not calling this in.
They're both just extremely naive, and then this whole process has really opened their eyes to the reality of the world.
But they...
It's a dog-eat-dog world out there.
But they uncover the answering machine message... when they're freaking out, and that leads them down a path where they realize that they don't feel so bad about what's going on so far, but they are in peril and they need to start doing some other stuff. And
yeah, interestingly, they don't feel bad enough to steal the cash, which I felt like was an oversight, maybe.
Well,
or at least like they would have left most of it and, like, you know, slipped one little stack of money into their pants as the cops were carrying the body away.
Except there's something incriminating about the suitcase full of money. And
I feel like there's something incriminating about a lot of stuff that happens in this movie. Though, but, so they're very much... This whole movie is a gray area.
Yeah, but if
it's,
they...
It's a Labor Day weekend long gray area.
If they ever... the grayest of Labor Day. Don't wear gray pants after Labor Day. But if they got caught with this money on them, then it would just be real bad for them.
Well, I hate to break it to him with regards to Weekend at Bernie's 2, but that is ostensibly the plot of
yes,
the movie.
That is the plot of that movie. But, you know, different writer or whatever, director stuff, things happen. But for this one, you have your money from the supposed murder-suicide, and they find the note, and it's a weird... thing where Andrew McCarthy's character was going to kill Jonathan Silverman's character because he found out that Jonathan Silverman's character was having an affair, but the money was for this sex change, and that's why they were embezzling it. So it's this weird transphobic, homophobic thing that didn't necessarily need to be in the movie, but it was.
No, but what would a terrible 80s low-budget movie be without some sort of, like, stupid, childish sexuality nonsense?
Yeah, and I guess it's supposed to be written from the point of view of Bernie, but the fact that Andrew McCarthy seems so disturbed by it and thinks that it's reality for a minute, for 30 seconds, seems to make it that the movie wants you to think it's funny, but whatever. That's not the point. It's all so badly written in here, all this. And then you just start this enormous series of hijinks for trying to take the body around with them so that they can prove that they're alive. So they're going to put the body in the cart and drive in the cart, and they're going to go to the ferry.
Right, because they think the deal was kill them. They don't know that he was killed by the hitman as sort of like a backstab from the mob. They just think that he died from his drug overdose. But as long as he's around, as per the voicemail, that they won't get killed. So they tie the shoelaces together. He scampers around with them. Hilarity, dead body, mm-hmm. etc.
And there's an enormously long boat chase.
They had a boat. They had like the permit for a whole day. Like, you know, what are they gonna do? They got the dummy that they can drag behind the boat. Like, what else are you gonna do?
Yep, I guess that's the real moral of the story. You got a permit for a day and a dummy, so go for it. But again, it gets so
slapstick with the like pushing all the buttons on the boat, and the back flap starts mm-hmm. to go up, and it lifts Bernie up, and then. Hey, did you hear a sound or whatever? And he's bouncing off all of the channel markers and stuff. And
ping, ping, ping. Yeah, it's a little much. And then they go back to the house and they rendezvous with Gwen. And she finally finds out that this is all real and that there really is a dead body. And she's freaking out.
Like, I still don't even know if she ever believed any of it, but when what's-his-name, like, comes in, like, all crazy-eyed because he's killed Bernie twice already and he's still standing there and just, like, straight up shoots him in the chest, like, six times. And he's like, oh, finally. The Gwen's just literally like, what in God's name is happening right now? I don't even care if, like, what you said earlier was true. Like, we need to leave now because this is absurd and ridiculous, and there's a man there with a gun and he's going to shoot us.
What I don't buy is the little closing coda here of Gwen and Jonathan Silverman and Andrew McCarthy just yucking it up on the beach on the sand while there's a crime scene being taken apart next to them.
Getting their photo taken with the sheriff and stuff.
Yeah, like that. That does.
Well, they get some credit for knocking out the bad guy.
Yeah, but
job well done.
You would think that Gwen would be like, I never want to see you again. Like, you were the creepiest creep who ever creeped. And your friend.
I mean, I assume that, you know, he's being honest now. He's being truly honest with her. And if she buys that, you know, it's like when people go through serious traumatic events together, they come out the other side bonded for life.
Or you realize that the liar who lives with his parents was staying at the house of a neighbor that you knew in life, and that neighbor is dead, and they hauled his dead body around in order to stay at his house this whole entire time.
Yeah, it's probably one of those better safe than sorry, never speak to this person again kind of things.
Yes.
But, you know, it was the 80s. People were a little bit more forgiving. The climate was a little less serious. You could afford to give people a second chance socially.
Especially the fact that she would even socialize with Andrew McCarthy is just like...
Yeah.
Just be careful you never pass out around Andrew McCarthy, where he's going to, like... turn you into a puppet show.
He's going to take you to the movies to get like a 2-for-1 deal or something.
Yeah. He'll put you in his car and you drive in the carpool lane.
Yeah. These days, after the first date was like weird or whatever, she would have like looked at his Twitter feed and just saw that he's like a complete creep psycho and just been like, you know what? No. I'm going to avoid this.
I feel like that's an important life lesson for people from the 80s. Just realize everyone's a creep.
do your research is what it is. I mean, you know, maybe it's nowadays we're all so high strung and so much anxiety because we have too much information. And really, we should just like, we should be a little more head in the clouds and just sort of wander around. And, you know, that's how you get into to hijinks and antics. And, you know, you have a fun Labor Day weekend, even though your boss tried to have you killed.
Or head in the sand. That's one way to go.
Head in the sand. Yeah. I mean, you got to admit it was kind of funny the way, I mean, obviously it's played for dumb laughs that like everyone on the island is still like having fun and partying. And they're like, oh no, Bernie died. Okay, let's go play some beach volleyball or whatever. But like the way his body comes flying off that gurney and flops down behind them and the lady waves and they turn around and see him. It's again, it's just a perfect Scooby-Doo moment. They run off into the distance and then roll credits.
I think the biggest, and then there was a dead body moment for me where I laughed was... the where they're kissing on the shore.
Yeah, wait, what, that yeah. Yes, that's a great sight gag for camera work.
Yeah, because obviously, you know, you put Terry on like a gurney or something like a board so that you can push him in and out. And they do with the wave, and he is acting as ragdoll and out of it as he's supposed to be for going along with this wave.
And that's one of those ones where I'm not sure if they actually got a dummy or if that was actually him.
I think he was really on a board that they pushed into the shot and then pulled back out again.
It's you know, you can tell where they blew their budget on this movie.
ADR. No, but I mean, so, you know, there are like a couple of yuck-em-ups or whatever, but I mean, honestly, this movie on the whole, like, maybe we shouldn't have dedicated one of our precious episodes
to it.
Yeah,
one of our precious episodes after AVP. Yeah. No, I think there are reasons that this movie sticks out in history for one reason or another. And I feel like this is the kind of movie that if it's like on TV at like 3 in the afternoon on a Sunday and you're just sitting around just kind of tired or hungover or something, you go like, yeah, I'll watch half of this. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, but let's be honest. The reason anybody remembers this movie is dead person puppetry. Like that's it. And so that's why the second movie is just all 100% dead person puppetry. But
and it's just too stupid to be insulting or offensive, or it's like, it's too dumb to be in poor taste. Like they took poor taste off of the table from the opening scenes of this movie that you're like, yes, poor taste. Now let's move on. Slapstick.
Yeah. But I think that's about it. I don't have anything else to say. You?
Yeah. No, I don't know. It looked like a fun Labor Day weekend, aside from all of the murder and death and stuff.
Yeah.
I still wish that house existed. I would, you know, in the same way that they do all of those, like, goofy secrets cinemas and things, if that house were still around, I would totally, like, make like a weekend at Bernie's like a thing.
Well, you could always do that in Arizona. Just got lots of sand. You could just make your little house.
No. We don't have sand. We have dirt and we have clay.
All right.
It's
well,
very different than sand.
How far away is sand from you?
You know,
Lake Havasu
hours?
Or whatever.
California? No, Lake Havasu. Like the beach is made out of rocks and dirt.
Okay. Well, there was a show on the Food Network called Katie Lee's Beach Bites or whatever.
Yeah, I saw commercials for it. I never watched it.
God, it was so bad. She would go around to different beach cities and try like famous beach bites that they had. That of course is the title of the show. But for some reason, they're like, you know what? We don't want Arizona to feel left out, so we're going to have several episodes where we're eating at various restaurants around Lake Havasu. And it's like that doesn't count as a beach. Sorry, that doesn't work because you're going from like, you know, St. Petersburg or from one of the islands of Hawaii or California or whatever, and it's just like, and then we cut to Lake Havasu.
I mean it's bad to the point that like there are a couple of resorts here that have those pools that have like 100 yards of sand going into like a shallow pool to try and like mimic a beach, and it's depressing. We shot a video a number of years ago where we needed a beach, and the producers with the money insisted that we explore every potential possibility of shooting it in Arizona. So we looked at like sand volleyball pits. We looked at parks. We looked at these resorts and stuff. And all of the sand is like this like chunky brown gross, doesn't look anything like a beach. And like literally the closest usable sand we could find was in Marina Del Rey. So we drove to Marina Del Rey for one day of shooting.
Oh, that's kind of sad. Marina Del Rey is not exactly like the best beach.
It had a huge, I mean, it was huge and it looked nice. And it had that, you know, how it has that like 10-foot drop from the sand down to the water. So we had this like nice horizon where you didn't see all the people walking at the waterline.
Wait, were you at Marina Del Rey or Playa Del Rey?
I mean, I could give you the cross streets specifically. I don't know what the actual divisions are. I'm not a local Jew. I believe my permit was for Marina Del Rey. I don't know.
Well, I'm just curious because I don't. Marina Del Rey is more Marina than it is Del Rey. But
it's the part where it comes out to the ocean and then you go to the right a little bit, right there, where the marina meets the ocean, and then the beach just like just north of that.
You mean south?
No, we were north.
Okay, because that's like Venice.
Okay, it says Marina Del Rey on the map, so we were take Washington till you hit the dirt and then go south like three blocks.
Okay, so I guess technically that works as Marina Del Rey.
Yeah. Let's see here. We're Driftwood Street, or wait, is this the one where we backed the grip truck in? No, I think it was this one over here.
Are you sure you didn't shoot in North Carolina for any days and pretend it was the Hamptons?
North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Not bad. I mean, it looked all right. Everyone had their blue and white striped sweaters on, so they all looked very fancy.
Fancy. Yeah, so that's that. Let's discuss permits offline sometime.
Mm. Sure. Serious talk.
Serious permit talk.
Weekend at Bernie's made me feel so uncomfortable.
Oh, that's a song.
It's Pictures of Lily by The Who.
Oh. And scene.